Okay, let's turn back. Let's start today by turning back to Exodus 13, verse 3. I just want to call out the why we keep this day, just as a very quick scripture on why we are doing what we are doing, and then go into a subject that is relevant for us this day and in the coming week, the next 7 days. So Exodus 13, verse 3, Moses said to the people, and he sets the tone of what we do or think about this day. Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. For by strength of the hand of the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. And on the day you are going out in the month Abib, and it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you. No shall leaven be seen among you in all of your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt, and you shall keep, therefore, this ordinance in its season from year to year. And that is the reason why we keep this day. Now, we think, oh, that's an antiquated thing for us to do to put out leavening, but God says that we keep that and we do that. And there's a reason why we do that. We put out the leavening, but what I want to point out here is it more doesn't just say that. It's not just putting out leavening. It is actually saying eat of the unleavened bread each day, which is the more important part for us to think about. A lot of times we just talk about, hey, putting out leavening, and I, you know, cleaned and I threw this out and I found this and oh no. But it's really more about the day of actually eating unleavened bread, of eating of the Christ as our bread. He says, I'm the bread of life. Who came to me, comes to me shall never hunger. Right? He is the bread of life, and he's referred to as that. And he's a living bread which came down from heaven. So this is not just a defensive posture of us going to say we are putting out leaven, which is a type of sin, but it is a posture of eating of the unleavened bread each day. Think of it more like that. That's why it's called the days of unleavened bread, right? It's not called the days of putting out leavening. It's called the days of unleavened bread, and we eat of that each of these days. And that's where the emphasis should be. The emphasis should be on what we actually are doing these weeks, or this week. So it's eating the bread. So I'm not going to cover that in depth today, but I want to cover another angle. It's very interesting about this, that God brought them out with a strong hand. And what did they come out of? They came out of, it says, the house of bondage, out of Egypt. And, you know, we have a type of Egypt, the world. We have a type of the ruler Pharaoh of Egypt, which is Satan. And what's interesting is if we look at what happened to Israel when they came out with a strong hand, is that Satan did not give up. You know, in fact, they pursued. Like, if we think about this, Pharaoh of Egypt came after them. He pursued them. He was mad. He was infuriated. He drove his chariots. He tried to kill them. He, you know, chased them. And what God had to do is continue to protect them that whole time. And he wasn't going to let them go. You know, even after all the devastation of the plagues, even after the firstborn died and all the things and just the rivers and all the mess that was there, you would think the guy would give up, but he didn't. He did not give up. And, you know, when you think about this, that pursuit is something that is always going to be there with us, like it was with Israel. There's going to be a pursuit. He's going to try to come after you. He's going to try to pursue you. Now, we think about this, we look at this for 7 days. What does this have to do with 7 days? Why do we do this for 7 days, by the way? Why not three? Why not five? You know, why is it 7 days that we're actually doing this? And I have to ask you, too, is it just, you know, seven normal days to you? Or how do we view this? Is this just another 7 days of the year and come on the first day and come on the last day and then, hey, that's a bookend and let's call it a wrap. There was the feast. You know, why are we doing this for actually 7 days? Why is that? It all has to do with what I'm talking about here, with Pharaoh, with the God of this world, with Satan coming after us. He's not going to let you go. And the thing is sometimes we don't even realize how he works. And these days have everything to do with countering how he works or to help. Now let's talk about one of these concepts, 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3. Let's look at this battle and where it's waged, how it's waged, and what results in it, and what these 7 days have to do with that. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3 tells us this. 2 Corinthians 10, 3 says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war against the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." This is the battle. This is the battle. And we'll notice that where it puts the battle is it says it's not carnal. What does that mean? It's not our physical thing you see in front of you. Ancient Israel had battles that were physical. They went and fought. But it says it's not physical. It's not carnal. But it's mighty in God. And it's for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments. Notice what all these things are. All of these things are things that have to do with thinking and thoughts and things that get lodged in our thinking. It says bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience to Christ. Thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. What are those type of things? Those type of things are where the battle takes place. That when Satan wants to pursue us, he is going to get us to, and the way he will do it, is to get us with all types of arguments, all types of talk, all types of things that get in the way of what God is really doing or saying or how God is working or things that lodge in your brain that you get stuck on. This concept is how he works. These are the ways in which Satan works. And one of the things that is talked about here and I want to go through today is this pulling down strongholds. It's mighty in God for the pulling down of strongholds. Now, what's a stronghold? When we look at this term, it's really a military term, you know, for a fortified place. Used in that back in that day, in literal sense, right? It was a fortified place. And that means that if you are in a battle, it's a place where you go build the walls up. You put a big gate on it. You put a lock. You put a moat. You know, you put alligators in it. It's a place where it's very heavily defended. It's very heavily fortified. It's you can't easily get or break into it type of a place. And that's the idea of what a stronghold is. Now, the way strongholds are established and the way Christ, the way Satan works on us to establish them is what this scripture is talking about. It's all the thinking, it's all the arguing, it's all the churning, it's all the ideas, it's all these things that kind of get wedged in our brains that start to build these strongholds. It's the arguments and the reasoning, right? It's the things like that. You know, a bastion. The term the bastion of vaunted human reasoning is a bastion, it's a stronghold. It's very close to the term that Paul was using here, a secular term, a bastion of vaunted human reasoning. It's the same idea. The human reasoning that we go through, that we have, Satan plays on with us to get us to often a place. So a stronghold is an idea. It's something that Satan wedges in. He gets us to think, and he gets it stuck. And he gets it so stuck, it's like that fortress with the walls and the moat and the alligators. It won't come undone. It's something that's so strong and so stuck there that we can't get it out. It's either a sin or it starts with an idea. All the sins that we have start with some idea. Something in there that says, you know, I was done wrong. Or, you know, this was very difficult, which could be true. And therefore, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, strike this person. Or it's a sin that says, you know, I had, you know, all of this happened to me, so I've got an excuse for doing this. All of those things start with an idea that gets lodged in our brains somehow. This is how Satan works. It's a spiritual warfare. We're not fighting physically, but we're spiritually fighting this. How does a stronghold actually start to get built? Ephesians 4:26, you don't have to turn there. It just says, "Do not give the devil a foothold." Don't give the devil even the start of a foothold, right? When we think about this, that means don't let him step. Don't have him, let him have a step into your life or the start of an encroachment or a part of one. Don't give him any room for those type of things. Don't let him gain a foothold or a toehold or just a toe. Don't let that get dipped into your life. Now, when we look back in war and history, like the Normandy beach invasion of World War II is a perfect example of what a foothold is. They Allies were trying to establish a beachhead right off the coast of France. And what happened, I don't know if you've seen any of the movies that depict this scene that happened there. They're quite gruesome. They're quite an incredible experience that those men of war had to go through. But what they were trying to do, they were trying to actually just get into the coast of France, and they couldn't. They would land people on the beach, and they would get, you know, just mowed down. And if you've seen Saving Private Ryan and other ones that depict the scene, amazing carnage that happened here. But they were trying to establish what was called a beachhead. They needed a place where they could get a start, you know, get a foothold, just get a step into the land, and then they could set up there and then kind of keep pushing the enemy back. That's the idea when it says don't give the devil a foothold. It's the same picture of giving Satan a beachhead in your life, giving him a way in, giving him a foothold in our life. When this happens, and when, you know, the armies eventually, with all the carnage and all the lives lost, were able to push in, they were able to push back and push the enemy back over a period of time. But it had to start with a beachhead. And that's how war, and that's how this effort, and that's what a foothold means, is don't even let the start of it start happening. Don't let it get a foothold, because a foothold then turns into a pushback, and then it turns into an entrenched position, which is a stronghold. And so these scriptures all tie together of how this process works. And again, how does it start? It starts with ideas. It starts with things that are in our head. And Satan is very adept at this. It's what he does. Satan's very good at this. You know, he wedges himself into our thinking somehow. And he's honed this for years and many, many millions of years. But he does, and he gets into our thinking where he wedges himself between you and God. And think about this. When this is exactly what he did with the angels. How do you get a third of the angels to follow him? Is he gained a foothold into their thinking. He put a little wedge between them and God. And that wedge grew, and it stuck, and it became a stronghold, and it festered, and then they, you know, pretty soon what happened is actions came out of that, the sin came out of that, and the other angels and the fallen angels ended up following Satan. Can you understand that they were in front of a perfect God and a perfect ruler, and Satan still wedged that? He still found something. And this is how Satan works. Satan usually works with us and through us by injustice. You know, something that's done to us wrongly could be completely real. But he also works, and he doesn't have to even have it to be real to put a wedge to make you feel like you've been done wrong. You know, it's, you know, people perceive me this way, or all these types of things get into our thinking, and they put a wedge, and then that wedge festers, and that thing festers and gets stuck into our psyche. And he's very good at this. And it usually works through hurts, something that's deeply ingrained or part of our psyche. So after a while, what that stronghold is something that just becomes part of who we are. We think, you know, this is just how I am. I'm this way, you know. And these are hard to deal with concepts that he gets wedged in there. Things about feeling loved. I know all of us have grappled with that. Does God actually love me or not? Or has he cast me off? Is he no longer there? You know, there's a lot of these things that Satan will put in there and make a wedge that all of a sudden the thinking gets stuck and becomes who you are. You know, I'm just an outcast of God and his people, versus figuring out how we cast down these arguments, because those are arguments. Like it says, anything that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. The knowledge of God is what he says in his Bible, that he loves you, that he's sent his son, and all of these things are the knowledge of God. Anything that exalts itself to put it between you and that, think of it like that, is how Satan wedges, and this becomes a stronghold. It becomes a stronghold, like I said, when it becomes a part of us. It's so deeply ingrained. It's just we think, yeah, that's just how I am. That's just who I am. This is just what it is and how it is. And when we talk like that, that becomes a stronghold. And so we want to think about this and look at it. So strongholds can be something that's like that. We don't want to let Satan get a foothold even, like the Normandy beach, to set something up, to push back, to make it and set up shop. A stronghold can also be an object of confidence, though. Proverbs 21:22. Talking about a stronghold here. This is a wise man, Proverbs 21:22. A wise man scales the city of the mighty and brings down the trusted stronghold. So here we have the idea of a stronghold being a confidence, something you trust in, something you feel is sure, a state of confidence and security, you know, of somebody who is mighty, somebody who has set themselves up in a place. You know, we think, oh, wouldn't God want us to be confident, though? Of course he does, but this is not what this is. This is a stronghold that you want. This is something that is your confidence outside of God. This is something you trust in outside of God. This is the story of Nebuchadnezzar. You remember that? When he was set up as ruler and he was walking around his kingdoms and how much money and military power and might and power he had. And he said, you know, my hands have gotten me this. And what did God do? God took down that stronghold, took it away from him and his, you know, everything and turned him to an animal for a period of years to where when he woke up, he no longer trusted in those things. And he said, God, you are able to set things up and take it down, and praise to be your name. So that's this type of a stronghold. When we get set up in confidence with something that's outside of God, it could be our money, it could be our position, it could be anything like that that we trust in outside of God, those things can also be a stronghold that God may take down. God may is more interested in us learning the bigger lesson in life sometimes. And so stronghold can be that. Now, a way that Satan also works, let's turn over to Ephesians 6, verse 13 with this. Ephesians 6, verse 13. Ephesians 6, verse 13. Talking about battle again. Notice this is a battle. And this topic is about battle and strongholds. Ephesians 6, 13 says, therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand, stand. So the punctuation's a little off there. It's, you know, it says having done all, it says to stand, and they put a period, and then it's stand therefore. It's really saying, if you have done all to stand, comma, stand, exclamation point. Once you've armored yourself and all these things, then stand. Therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, and above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you'll be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all saints. Again, above all, taking what? A shield of faith, which you'll be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. There's the same concept again. When we see this battle and how it happens and how it works, this is another thing. What's a fiery dart? I know today we have the luxury or the detriment, however you want to look at it, of seeing movies that can depict things like this, you know, make it very visual for you. But if you've ever seen any of the movies, Lord of the Rings or any of the stuff where they're shooting bows and arrows, this is where they have an arrow that's dipped in tar usually, and they will light the tip on fire and then start shooting at people. Now, in battle, this is one of the most feared things that you could see coming at you for a couple of reasons. One is, obviously, it's fire. And when it, you know, lands on you, you end up getting not only, you know, shot with an arrow, but you're burned. It's a severely painful way to die. But not only that, is it would strike fear in people, because when you shoot an arrow like that, the fire goes like this, and it's really hard to exactly see where the arrow is going, because it looks like it's kind of wavering all over the place. And so people would see this and panic and turn and run when you start to see these fiery darts. And that's what this is talking about. And this is how Satan works at us. When you think about the war that we go through, he's going to take something that will maybe scare you, maybe strike fear in you, maybe make you get weak, and shoot it at you, a fiery dart. And that'll come straight at you. And it's the same type of thing. You can lose your nerve and go, ah, and you panic and you run. This is how he works. He does not, this is not a fair fight. He does not fight fair. So we need to understand the way that this works. And how does that block? If you ever see in the movies, how do you block that? You know, people without shields are the ones who get, you know, shot with the arrows. But you see everybody else crouching down with a shield and doom. That fiery dart hits that, not them. And that's why it says here, above all, take the shield of faith. It's giving you a metaphor of armor and using in battle, but it's very important to understand that's the shield stops that arrow, and how and what is that shield? It's called faith. That is saying that, yeah, it may look like this, and it's going to come at you wavering like this, and you have to just stand and have faith in God and not what you see, and not what that dart looks like, and not how it's scaring you, and not what that is coming at you. So that shield of faith that what you raise, looks like this, and I'm going to panic, but I'm going to have faith. And you raise the shield above all. So same concept here of striking, getting a foothold, getting something that in your psyche throws you off, trips you up, makes you doubt, makes you anything that comes between you and the knowledge of God, that he loves you and died for you, and he's going to finish his work in you, is a fiery dart. And that's how Satan works. And so we see that this is a spiritual warfare. And there's a sermon in and of itself around the the whole armor of God, which we won't go through today. But it's very fascinating to see what we need to equip ourselves for this battle. It's a number of things that are there. It's a well-rounded set of things. But I want to just concentrate on the fiery darts and talk about that shield of faith for a second. So again, it's all about ideas, things that land and stick, things that get in your brain, things that come between what God really feels about you, and it grows and it festers over time. These can both be haughty and self-destructive. You know, Satan will work on people's pride in a big way and say, you know, you're missing out. You should have been this, or you should be that, or, you know, you're better than some of this. And it could be haughty, and that is something that sticks in the brain and can fester over time, and then people act on it. If you think about this, though, the warfare we're in always starts with an idea. Somewhere that's behind a sin, there's going to be some idea. This is how it works, and it starts and it festers and turns into something. So then people think, I could have been more. I should be this, and I'm going to leave, and I'm going to take a bunch of people with me, or, you know, all these things start with some idea. It could be haughty. It could be self-destructive like that. It could be anything like that. Or it could be very, you know, self-defeating. You know, he cares about everybody else, but not me. You know, all of these things are things that become lodged into our brains and how we start to think. And the reason I'm bringing this up is this is how he works, but there is great strength and great solutions in this day. There is a great thing that we think about when we go through the days of unleavened bread that specifically addresses how do we bring these things down? How do we bring these things down? So let's not let a fiery dart get lodged under our skin, but that's why we need to be aware of it. Again, it starts with a feeling. So what does this have to do with the days of unleavened bread? Why 7 days? What does 7 days have to do with any of this stuff? You know, what does the number seven signify? If you look in the Bible, I'll just quote you. There's at least 128, I think, different references to what seven, at least, more than that, refers to. Seven generally is a number of completeness, right? You got the 7 weeks, the week starts and the week finishes. You had seven trumpets, you have seven churches. You have seven angels to the seven churches. You have seven last plagues. You have seven seals, seven thunders, seven trumpets, seven spirits of God. 7 days to create the heavens and the earth, completion. 7 days of the week, we have seven holy days. We had seven clean animals in the ark. We had seven fat cattle and seven lean cattle in some of the visions. We have seven things that God hates. When a thief steals, he has to restore sevenfold, complete restoration back. We have 7 weeks between unleavened bread and Pentecost. We have seven loaves of bread after Christ fed the masses and seven baskets left over of collected. We forgive each other 70 times seven. That's multiples of seven and seven. And that's a completeness, complete forgiving. We have seven major divisions of the Bible, the law, the prophets, the writings, the gospel, the Acts, general epistles of Paul, and Revelations. And all of these things signify something being completed or complete, a completion. And if you want to think about it that way, this is how we think about the process that we go through for 7 days is one that we don't start complete, but it takes a period of time for us to be complete, to be healed, to come out of sin, to go through the journey that you and I go through, to come out the other side, to be saved, to enter into his promised land, It is a 7-day or a time of completeness. And we see other examples in the Bible. Moses waited on Mount Sinai until the 7th day before God spoke to him, a time period of silence. Right? One time the armies of Syria and Israel camped opposite each other for 7 days before engaging in battle. Another occasion, the army of Israel took a roundabout journey of 7 days on the way back to Moab. Job's friends sat with him for 7 days in silence before they began to speak and ruin it all, but 7 days. When transported to the exiled Israelites, Ezekiel also sat in silence for 7 days. And so we have this thing that's seven in this completeness in this time period. And so this is what and why we have 7 days here, is we have to think about this as a time of completeness, as a time and a process of completing what God has. What God has started in you, he will complete, and the seven signifies it's a time period. It's a period of time that this will take place through. Not just, hey, one done, got baptized, everything's great. There is a journey and a process that we have to go through to complete what God started in us, and the 7 days signifies that. But specifically, seven also means something very much in the days of unleavened bread that relates to what we were talking about just before. When we were talking about pulling down strongholds and casting down arguments and reasoning, we actually have an example in the Bible of pulling down a stronghold that's super instructive for us to think about during these days of unleavened bread. We have a stronghold. You can probably name it. Can you think of a stronghold? There's a lot of strongholds that were mentioned in the Bible. Yes, Jericho. The city of Jericho. This was a stronghold. What was the problem here? It stood in the way of Israel getting into the promised land. Was this stronghold? So it's a city that they needed to go through to be able to take the promised land. And it was a fortress that was impenetrable. And the way, though, that this was taken down was not done in the typical military fashion. And this is what we learn for these days. When we think about the strongholds and we think about Jericho, this approach tells us a lot of things. Now, Jericho, why was it so scary or so hard to get through? Well, they've done some excavations on the site where it was, and they've discovered quite a few things. But one of the things that they know is that the walls were massive. When I say massive, it wasn't just, hey, here's just one great big wall. What happened was it was on a mound or a tell, right? So off the ground. So all around the sides were sloped up like this. So if you were to walk around the whole thing, you're going uphill to get up to actually where the city was. Now, at the bottom of this hill, there was a retaining wall. So at the very bottom, around all the way around the thing, was a retaining wall that started about 12, 15 feet high. I don't know, just think about this right here, the ceiling, somewhere around there. Started to be about 15 feet high. That's one, wall of solid rock that's just massively, massively wide. And then on top of that, 6 feet thick. So I'm about 6'4". So that thick. Yes, I'm thick. Thank you very much. So, all right. So on top of that, 6 feet thick and about another 26 feet high on top of this. So say 15, say another 26 feet high after that. Was another wall that was straight up like that. So you start out at 15 feet and you add another 26 feet on top of that, a really thick wall that's really hard to get through. Now, those days they didn't have Abrams tanks and helicopters and bombs and all this other stuff to be able to knock this down. So it started that, but that wasn't it. On the other side of that wall, you had ground that went basically sloped way up like this. Right, so if you were to happen to get over this wall, you would be in this area of ground that's exposed that goes straight up. So you're running uphill. Now, when you get up the hill, there's another wall at the top there. Now, this wall is similar to the one that I just described at the bottom, sloped hill up, and another 46 feet going up this way. So if you think about an army trying to take this place, you would have to not only get over the massively high, thick, solid, wall at the bottom, then you have to go up a hill in an exposed area, so there's people sitting up on these walls, can just pick you off. Go up that hill, uphill, and then another 46 feet high wall at the top of that. So double walls, uphill. And if you know anything about military, you know, or played video games, if you get the high ground and you shoot down, that's the advantage that you have. So when they looked at the city, human speaking, it's impossible to figure out how do you get into the city. This is what's called a stronghold, and Jericho was labeled that as a stronghold. And not only that, the citizens of Jericho were prepared for a siege. Inside their fortress, they had a spring that gave and fed them water. So they had an endless supply of water. They're not going to run out of water. And not only that, at this time of the year, they had just done taking in the harvest. So they had a ton of food inside this place, abundant supply of food. And they found this, they found this out by when they did excavation, they found so many big jars that were full of grain, all throughout the city. So basically, think of this. They had plentiful food. They had plenty of water. They could have held out for years inside here. And there's no way to get over these walls. So Jericho was truly the definition of a stronghold. And from the outside, it was impossible for them to see how this thing could go down. If you're physically marching around this, you just go, we have no clue. I have some bows and arrows and swords. I can hit the rock wall. But they don't have all the big machinery we have today. And so it's impossible for them to physically see how you could bring down this stronghold. Now think about that for you and I. When I talk about a stronghold, I really mean a stronghold. I mean something that's stuck inside you, in your head, in your thinking, that you just think is the way it is, the way you are, the way it is for you and will always be. That is something that is a stronghold that you think, I'll be like this till I die. A stronghold is something that's lodged that far into your thinking that you feel like it's you. That's exactly how fortified this was. That's exactly what the city looked like physically. And the point about the days of unleavened bread is when this whole takedown happened, is that it was taken down not by what we can see, but it was done in a supernatural way. So let's go through that story here. We'll go through the story. Turn back to Joshua 6. Joshua 6. We'll just cover how it was done. Joshua 6, starting in verse 1. Says, now Jericho. Now notice something here. Sorry as I read through this. I'll pause for a second. Notice how many times 7 is mentioned here. So when I say, like, hey, why do we do it 7 days? And, 7's completion and 7 for taking down strongholds and 7 for unleavened bread. It's not coincidence. These things all tie together. So Joshua 6, verse 1. It says, now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor. So why did God say that? Had the city fallen by then? It's still sitting there. Hey, see, I've given them to you already. God declared the victory for them ahead of time. This is something that's very interesting. God can say this to you. Hey, your stronghold, I'll give it into your hands. I will declare the victory for you for this. Did they still have to do something here? And this is the point. They still had to do a ton, but God declared the victory ahead of time for them. It wasn't a magical like that. In fact, they did a lot. Look what they did. So I've declared the victory. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You should go all around the city once. This you shall do for 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the 7th day, so each day they were to march around the city one single time, and they had 7 trumpets and all. But the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priest shall blow the trumpet, and it shall come to pass that they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man straight before him. And then Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, proceed and march around the city and let him who is armed advance before the Ark of the Lord. So seven is mentioned 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least five times in that just a few sets of scriptures there. Seven are, you know, seven priests, seven trumpets, 7 days, seventh day. You know, all these type of things it's mentioned multiple times there. And again, it is a period of time that that's describing. This is a model. This is a pattern that God gives us for taking down strongholds. Think about it like that for a second. This is a pattern, a way to take down something that is a stronghold that feels and looks like it will never be different and never change, is by this. So let's go to verse 8. It says, so it was when Joshua had spoken to the people that the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horn before the Lord advanced and blew the trumpets. And the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. Now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout. Then you shall shout. That's very interesting. This is not a, our weapon is not our voice in this case. Our weapon is not to taunt the enemy. They weren't marching around going like, you're going down, and you know, they were not to say anything. Why is that? It was not up to them and what the power of what they could say or taunt or, I'll show you, you know, there's nothing like that going on here. The command was to don't make any sound with your voice. Do not say a word. March around in silence. Do you think they were getting taunted? You better believe it. And made fun of and ridiculed and spat on and stuff thrown. Think about that. This is what's going to happen when you circle your fortress. This is what will happen. Just to scare you off from it, from doing it, from going through with it. It's daunting. It doesn't look like it can happen. You're going to get ridiculed. You're going to get tormented for it. But God says, don't worry. Don't say anything. Go around in silence. You think after a few days of silence, they probably started to go, what is going on here? They probably started to not realize it. What is happening here? But it says, don't say anything. The taunting will come back the other way. When you try to take down your Jericho, whatever that is, it will be like this. But don't say anything. Surround it. Do this. And verse 11 says, he had the Ark of the Lord circle the city, going around it once. Then they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priest took up the Ark of the Lord. Then the seven priests bearing seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord went on continually and blew with the trumpets. And the armament went before them. But the rear guard came after the Ark of the Lord, while the priests continued to blow the trumpets. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned to camp. So they did this for 6 days. So, completely interesting pattern here. Now, could God have taken that down on the first day? For sure. But this tells us something. God wants you to march like this. God wants you, when you look at a problem that is like a stronghold in your own life, that it's going to take you some time to surround it. You know, sometimes you and I don't value things. This sounds funny, that you get for free. You know, this is a principle at work. You give people stuff for free, they go, ah, whatever, sometimes. But you make them pay for it, they go, oh, that must be worth something. You know, it must be worth something when I had to pay, you know, And sometimes I think when we think about this for some miracles we have in life. I know people have been healed instantly from miracles and then just gone. Because it was too much of a, hey, just had it and took it away. Sometimes people have stayed with that. But more often than not, not the case. And then we wonder sometimes, why do I have to just keep going through this? And then I think part of it's in the answer of this pattern too, because it's an effort, it's a struggle, it's a keep going, and then when God does take it away, you know God took it away. You know your God. You know the pain that was there before. You know the marching that was there. You know the feeling of what it was. You know how it was to be taunted. And now you know that what God gave you, you can appreciate that so much deeper. You can be eternally grateful to the deepness of your bones for those type of things. But again, they still had to go out and to march and march and march. In verse 15, it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early, and at the dawning of the day, they marched around the city seven times in the same manner. And on the day they on that day only they marched around the city seven times. And the seventh time is when it happened, when the priest blew the trumpet, that Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, in it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who were in her who are with her in her house, because she hid the messengers that were sent. And you, by all means, abstain from these accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of these accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and the gold and the vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets, and it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. Those walls that I described to you just fell down. When they excavate the site, the walls are falling down. This literally happened. Fell down. Just completely fell down. And the people went up into the city, every man straight before him. And they took the city. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and women, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, and the edge of the sword. It was brought down completely. And the idea of this too is, when yours is brought down, we want to burn the remnants of it too. We'll get rid of it, be done with it. Don't keep going back to visit it. God wants the victory to be complete. He does. It will take the time. It will be this march. It's not an automatic thing. But he can give the victory, and he does give the victory. And we go, you'll notice that they always had to do things. In verse 22 as well, it says, "Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, 'Go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the women and all that she has, as you swore to her.' And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, the father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had." Why? Because she showed faith, and faith in God. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside of the camp of Israel. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and the gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into a treasury of the house of the Lord. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. And Joshua charged them at the time, saying, "Cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds the city of Jericho. He shall lay its foundations with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up his gates." So the Lord was with Joshua. So this is a super interesting pattern here. You'll notice what started out as an evil city and a stronghold could not be brought down, that we're giving a pattern to follow here. And when it was done, it turned into something with all the gold and the silver that could be consecrated and shown to glorify God. It's you and I. That's you and I. It's exactly the pattern that we go through with our lives. That looks like something that's stuck. We have to not just face it and be daunted and give up. We have to march. And this is what the Days of Unleavened Bread tells us. Why 7 days? This is when they did this. Why 7 days? Because this pattern on the Days of Unleavened Bread of bringing down a stronghold is what it takes. This is what it takes. And God tells them and told them to march. God told them to circle around. And I have to ask you this. You, what's your Jericho? What stands between you and the Promised Land? Think of it like that. City of Jericho stood between them and the Promised Land. What stands between you and the Promised Land? You don't have to say it out loud, but you know. What is that? What is that? So, 7 days that we go through the Days of Unleavened Bread are a little bit of a difference. What's the thing that stands between you and the Promised Land? You know, some things are just harder than others to take care of. And that's the lesson of what these days are. You know, Elijah prayed 7 times for it to rain, and he had a servant run out and check every single time. Why? It's the same type of reason. Christ rebuked a spirit. His disciples couldn't. And he said, "Hey, this one doesn't come out except with prayer and fasting." There's some problems that are harder than others. There's some problems that take work. and a constant set of work through your life to overcome them. But God will give the victory. And again, when was that? It was on the seventh day. It was near the completion. It was near the end. And God said, it fell. I got it for you. So that's us. This is not 7 days of ho-hum, exact same days doing the same thing, or, hey, I started the first holy day, now the last holy day. We need to think about this pattern, and this is how we tackle our problems. This is how we do this in 7 days of unleavened bread. Are you circling like they circled every single day? Or have you just thrown your hands up? Hey, is this just how it is? You know, this problem's so hard, so much in there, it's just how it is. This is just how I am. Or are you circling that? And you asking God to give you that victory. But you have to circle. You have to march around. You have to go do these things as he showed them. They had to do them, but he gave them the victory. And it took a period of time, and it took a period of time of completion. So your toughest sins, the hardest things, those ideas that have been shot and got wedged and have festered and become something can be taken down. Not by carnal, conventional means, but how God gave the spiritual victory over Jericho is the pattern we have for the days of unleavened bread. Do you have a hard problem? Do you have something like that? Then you circle it. Think about the days of unleavened bread differently. 7 days we should be active. 7 days we should be circling our problems. You still have to march, but God will give you the victory. But he wants you to go through to completion of the 7 days to do it. An intense surrounding of a fortress. Circle it. Circle it. Circle it. Circle it. Circle it. Circle it. Is that six? Circle it 7 times on the last. Probably miscounted, sorry. But you get the idea of what I'm saying. That's what it takes. That's what it takes. What stands between you and the promised land is your Jericho. Circle it. We have a pattern. God will grant us the victory. He's begun a good work in you. We'll complete it. This is the process, the 7 days, and we have to circle it. Our weapons are not carnal, but they're mighty in God for the pulling down of strongholds.